Got it. Okay, this week's Parsha is Parshas Va'era, Tavshin Ayin Ches, and we will start on page 322. No, actually on page 320. That's Parak Vav, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Okay, Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe V'al Aaron. Hashem spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, Vayitzaveim El Bnei Yisrael. And he commanded them regarding the Jewish people, the El Pari Malach Mitzrayim, and regarding Pari King of Egypt, Loitzias Bnei Yisrael Meretz Mitzrayim, to take out the children of Israel from the land of Egypt. So Rashi comments on Pasuk Yud Gimel. This is the Rashi in the left column, about 2, 4, 6 lines from the top of that column. Vaydabra Hashem El Moshe V'al Aaron. The second Rashi, Vaytzaveim Bnei Yisrael. And he commanded them regarding Bnei Yisrael. What did he command Moshe on regarding Bnei Yisrael? Tziva aleim lanhiga menachas v'lis b'loisam. He commanded them to lead them with patience and to tolerate them. V'al Pari Melech Mitzrayim, and he commanded Moshe and Aaron regarding Pari king of Egypt. Tzivam alav, he commanded them regarding Pari, lachlek le'kavi b'divrayim, to give him honor in their words, to speak respectfully to them. He was telling Moshe and Aaron that when you address Paro, you address him respectfully. Meaning, as evil as he was, as bad as he was, you still have to show him respect. Now, I've always understood this Rashi to mean that, again, although you would say that Paro's behavior towards the Jewish people would make him not be deserving of respect, but he's still a king, and if he's still a king, you got to give him respect. Maybe it's a good political maneuver. You know, you got to be nice. If you're nice, then if you want something, you got to be nice. But, you know, I don't know if that's what... I always understood Rashi more as lachak, like covet, to give him honor, was more like of the idea of giving honor to a king. That's always understood it. But again, it seems what we're saying here is that, you know, as much as Paro is not deserving of the respect, you still have to give him the respect. So I saw in Rabbi Yisrael Reisman's Shiurim on the Parsha that he cites a very interesting thought from Rav Shimon Schwab Zatzal in his Sefer Mayim Beis HaSheva in a comment on Megillas Esther. And he brings out a very important principle and he applies it to this Rashi. And I have to be honest, I did not see, he is citing a comment from Rav Schwab in his Sefer Mayim Beis HaSheva. I did not have a chance to look it up inside. So I'm taking it from the way he brings it down, and also I'm really going to be saying it over in the way that I understand it. But again, this is based on, the at least on the idea that Rav Schwab conveys in his Sefer. Now, Rav Schwab is dealing with a very famous pasuk, and it's a pasuk that is used very often election and during election time. And that is Lev Melachim Biyad Hashem, which is only really part of the pasuk. The heart of kings is in the hand of God. And the question is, what does that mean? The heart of kings are in the hands of God. Kings don't think. Kings don't have any control. They have no free will. What does it mean exactly? And as Rob points out, is only the heart of kings in the hands of God, not everybody else's heart? Whatever it means that God is influencing the king and influencing what's happening with the king and that doesn't happen to other people, so what does it mean exactly? So, again, I will say this the way I understand it. And that is that Ribbono Shel Olam, we know, runs every aspect of the world. But part of the way that he runs the world is in a certain way where things seem to appear at least to follow what we call Derech HaTeva. They follow a pattern. They follow a natural pattern. And based on this natural pattern, there are certain expectations that we have. Now something happens out of the ordinary. In a way that you can't call it an open miracle, there's nothing supernatural happening. But what's taking place just doesn't make sense. This is not the way things are supposed to be happening. And that is very often what we refer to as Hashkacha Pratis, divine intervention, where if you look closely and you think about what's going on, you see the hand of Hashem working, of course, within nature, but working in the sense like, how did this happen? It doesn't really make sense it should happen. So for instance, that I was thinking, the example I was thinking, you know, they say that towards the end of World War II, Hitler diverted a lot of his war machine or a lot of the things that he could have used on the front to fight the Allies. Instead, he used it to hurry up the final solution. So in essence, as much as, you know, of course, brought about the demise of Jews, but because he was so focused on that, he really diverted a lot of things that he could have used that would have helped him fight the Allies. Instead, he took it away from his war machine, used it to destroy the Jews, and basically weakened himself that he was eventually defeated.
Yeah, he took all the Jews away from Hungary on these trains.
Okay, whatever it was. All the things that he could have used towards his own war machine, he took it away in order to destroy the Jews. And, you know, if you think about it, it's like, what are you thinking? You'll say, well, his hatred was so great, he didn't think. But if you think about it, right, it's like, fight your war. You've got the Jews under your control. Fight your war, and you'll finish the Jews afterwards. But the fact that he acted in such a way is very often seen as this was Hashkacha Pratit, this was Hashem's divine intervention, in the sense that whatever Hashem's reason were that so many Jews should have to be killed, but at the same time, it became part Hitler's own plans, Hitler's own desire to destroy the Jews became his demise, became his reason became his downfall. And this could be seen as an example of what we call divine intervention. Seems something that you can't say is supernatural, right? You can't call it supernatural, but it's very odd, it's very strange. And it's here where it's easier for us to see the hand of Hashem working. So the idea of Lev Melachim Yad Hashem, the heart of kings is in the hands of God, means that even if we don't necessarily see it, there is a lot of divine intervention going on by kings. Perhaps in some ways more than we have going on in other things. Now, of course, we believe there's divine intervention in everything. But in many of the things that happen, these things happen typically, things are again happening in a way that appears of the natural progression of events that go on. Yeah, sure, that sometimes we could all have stories of things like, you know, this weird thing happened, and because of that, everything worked out for the best, which again is where we see the hand of Hashem. When it comes to a king is a tool of Hashem to carry out his decrees. Because Hashem has created such a thing as kings and leaders and presidents and whatever leadership roles you want to have, and they have tremendous influence and tremendous impact on bringing about changes in the world for the good or for the bad. A king is Hashem's tool, and Hashem's intervention is happening by these kings in a way that maybe we don't notice, by a way that perhaps those who work for the king just say, well, this is how things work by a king. This is how things work in a president's office. This is how things work in politics or in a dictatorship, whatever it may be. But in essence, what's really happening here is a lot more intervention than we may be noticing. A lot of things are happening out of the ordinary and on a much bigger scale than we can imagine. And therefore, the king is in essence a king's rulership, and his decrees, and what he does are a manifestation of Hashem's running of the world on a level that's stronger or more intense than when it comes to other things. When it comes to other things, yes, there's divine intervention. Hashem is involved in everything. But things are kind of working typically in a certain natural way. By the king, because of the fact that a king has so much influence of changing things in the world and making such a big impact on such a large scale, there we have to know that Hashem's intervention is working, and Hashem's intervention beyond what would be nature or the regular routine, the regular natural progression of things, the things that think that the way we would expect things to work by a king, it's not happening that way. There's a lot more of Hashem's intervention actually making things happen in a way that typically wouldn't be happening. Maybe the king doesn't realize it, his advisor doesn't realize it, and people watching it don't realize it. But because this king, or whatever this king or any leader who influences power, is making a tremendous impact on people or on one country, on many countries around the world, Hashem's intervention is much stronger there. It's happening more there. And therefore, the idea of Lei B'lachem Yad Hashem is that we have to see that a king is, everything that a king is doing, he is Hashem's tool. Everything that a king is doing, we should see as a manifestation of his intervention, as a manifestation of his running the world. We should be looking at that, even if it doesn't seem to be out of the ordinary, we should be looking at it as this is how Hashem is bringing about his decrees that he wants to come about in the world. And other things, we don't necessarily see it that way. We're supposed to look at everything as Hashem's intervention, Hashem is running everything. But we have to be, but when it comes, and we have to see Hashem's hand in everything in the world. But when it comes to a king, to a leader, number one, we shouldn't fall into thinking that this powerful figure is actually just carrying out his own free will the way he wants to. But rather, we should be, but even when it comes to this powerful king, we should be seeing that no, it is Hashem's decree, it's Hashem's intervention that is influencing, that is directing how the free will of this leader is manifesting in how he impacts the world, and that Hashem's intervention in everything that's happening to him is more intense than we may even realize.
But I don't understand why there couldn't be just a simple explanation. So we all experience divine intervention, but CNN does not talk about it. What our life does not influence millions of people, and right. Therefore it doesn't sound so dramatic. But whatever a big leader does, when Stalin signed something saying, tomorrow, here's the law, you need to murder 1 million people. Well, all right, this affects people. So it's the same, I have to call it divine intervention, but it's just because that...
So then what is the stress on lay that the heart of kings in the hand of Hashem?
Observation that they influence a lot of people. And when
But again, from the point of Hashem's intervention, if there's no difference one way, whether it's him or you and your family, what's the point of saying it about the king more than anybody else?
The difference is in result.
Yeah, but again, from the point of what we have to have, how we have to look at Hashem as running the world, again, what do we need to stress that regarding the result? If it's all Hashem's intervention, which of course it is, right? But if there's really, no way in some way of seeing it differently, then why mention it? Of course it's in result. You know, a hurricane is also in result. An earthquake is also in result. What is it that the Torah is trying to bring out about the heart of kings? Now, I would agree with you that you could learn that, again, it's a reminder.
Right.
You know, and in the sense that here is this very powerful person.
It's
you know, and don't let yourself think that he's just deciding things on his own. He's being influenced and being led and being influenced by what Hashem wants things to happen. Despite what seems to be his power, it's Hashem is leading it that way.
To me, it sounds like a bad explanation.
Well, the thing is like this. So again. So you're saying there's no difference between him and everybody else, but just remember this is. But just remember that you know it's happening here too.
In particular, it also affects many more people.
Yeah, but I'm saying,
much more dramatic.
I'm not sure what you mean by dramatic in the sense that, you know, I get it. A hurricane is also dramatic. Earthquake is also dramatic. So I'm just saying, so the only difference between, if you want to stress something about a king, is because, again, you know, don't fool yourself into think, don't think it's just him. Don't just his free will acting out the way he wants to. Realize that actually his free will is being influenced by Hashem to bring out his decrees. And again, sure, and those decrees are very high impact. But again, he's essentially no different than anybody else. I think Rabbi Schwab is trying to say something more, because let me tell you what he wants to do now. Maybe your explanation of what we're saying now can work also. So he wants to say that the pshat here in Rashi about giving honor to Paro, right, is not like Paro doesn't really deserve it, but he's a king, and for some reason a king has to be given honor. Rather, Paro has to be seen as Hashem's tool. You know why you're giving him honor? It's because a king, right, is Hashem's tool for doing things.
We all are.
Okay, so we all are, right? So what's the stress here? So that's why I think he's trying to say is that there's something more is happening there. Something more is happening there. You should realize that when you see what he does, you should be seeing that as a shadow of Hashem's decree. It's somehow or another he's trying to say you should see this more. You're supposed to be seeing more of Hashem's hand in this more than in other things. Because again, right, it's everything is like that. Everything is Hashem's intervention. Hashem is running everything. But there's something here about a king that you should be seeing more there. And that's why you're giving honor to the king. You're giving honor to the king because you're supposed to be seeing Hashem's hand there more than in other things. And that's why I think he's trying to say that there's something going on by the king in some way more than what's happening regularly. What's happening regularly, of course, Hashem is running everything, but regularly things are happening in a pretty expected way. And by a king, you have to realize that things are happening much more in an unexpected way than you realize it.
Another possibility is that we should not generalize. And when they say king, they mean Pharaoh. And we know, in fact, in the text, it says several times that Hashem made his heart, I forgot the adjective.
So what are you trying to say?
So he tells Moshe and Aaron that I will be part of the king's actions. And in fact, he hardened his heart. They keep repeating the Torah, keep repeating that, right?
So you're trying to say this idea is only by Paro?
Right.
No, so that's why he brings that pasuk
right.
that we have right. in, I think it's in Mishle,
right.
Lei Malachim Yad Hashem. It's not just about Paro.
Well,
it's about all kings. The pasuk is talking about all kings. And therefore he's trying to say, and the idea of all kings is the idea here. If you want to understand Kavod Malchus, and he brings another, one second, let me just finish the idea. He brings another, there's a Gemara in Brachas that says, Ratzin Lirais Es HaMelech, I think it says. The point is, there's actually, the Gemara says, you should run to see a king. You should run to see a king. Now, and the Gemara says, that's not only a Jewish king. It's even a non-Jewish king. You should run to see a king. Why? The answer is because every king, in every king, you're supposed to see the hand of Hashem more. There's something unique in seeing a king that in seeing a king, you should be seeing Hashem. Because this king is his tool. And in some way or another, you should see him as a tool more than everything else in the world. What do you say, Alex?
Just saw it on CNN. In fact, they talked about Donald Trump. And they used exactly the same expression.
Yeah, they use it by everybody.
But the way it's interpreted, that the guy who's talking, doesn't know what he's talking.
So it's interesting. Yeah, it would sound almost like when you quote that pasuk, like he thinks he's talking, but he's really not talking.
Yes.
I would maybe say it a little differently. I mean, it's much easier to say it that way. I'm not 100% sure that we should be saying that he has no bechira. Like he thinks he's thinking it, but he's really not. He's really a robot, and he's not in any way practicing his free will.
Yeah,
I'm not so ready to say that, but at the same time,
and we shouldn't by definition.
In some ways, we shouldn't, but in some ways, at the same time, Hashem will play around with our free will, especially when, I would say, especially when essentially the choice is there, now just a question of how it's going to manifest itself. You know, Pharaoh is an example, but I'm saying if you're talking about all things. You know, if you want to talk about, again, going back to my example with Hitler, Yamach Shemai, right, where he wasn't thinking, right? So if we see that as Hashem's intervention, right, then there, I think you have to see that intervention possibly. I'm going to backtrack for a second. The Gemara in Gittin says, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai snuck himself out of Yerushalayim to speak to the Roman general before destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And he made three requests. And the Gemara says, why did he request that the Beis HaMikdash shouldn't be destroyed? So the Gemara quotes a pasuk that Hashem takes away the wise man's wisdom when need be. There is a certain intervention where, we're not being given the chance to do something. Because if the decree is to be specially destroyed, that's it. Then it's going to happen. And I think also, and whatever decree Hashem has, right, especially if the, like in a Paris sense or like in other evil people's sense, that they've already made their choice for evil very clear. Right, it's very clear that they made their choice to murder Jews, and they're always ready to do that. And therefore, now it's just a question of how to manipulate that free will. How am I going to use it? How is it going to manifest itself? So Hashem influences things. Hashem influences, and you could also say many times Hashem influences someone's free will, meaning Hashem can create an environment where I will probably make a certain choice. I still made the choice, but it'll create the environment for me to make the choice. That could be a challenge, or that could be a direction, in the sense of a king, the sense of a leader, the sense of whatever it may be. So the ultimate question that we have in Yiddishkeit is, if everyone has free will, if Hashem knows everything that's going to happen and he runs everything, how do we have free will? The ultimate question, okay? And we don't necessarily have a very good answer for it. But at the end of the day, there is still the idea that the person is still practicing his free will at some level or another, and Hashem is influencing that, because this is Hashem's tool for bringing out a certain decree, whether it be Haman, whether it be Paro, whether it be Achashverosh, whether it be whoever it may be throughout Jewish history. But at the same time, there is this idea that the leader is supposed to be somehow or another in a leader who impacts people, who impacts nations, who impacts the world. We should be seeing in that person that here there is a manifestation of Hashem's hand in a way more than in other ways. So whether it be Donald Trump, or whether it be Barack Obama, or whether it be Putin, or whether it be Netanyahu, whatever it may be, all these people who make their decisions and make big impacts on us and our country and on the world, they are Hashem's mean for carrying out His will. We could, as Baris said, we could take it on one level, in the sense that maybe he's talking no different than everyone else, or just being reminded, or maybe there is a deeper level, a greater level in some way that is happening by the kings. That because of that, we should be seeing the king as a manifestation of Hashem's honor, in a way that we don't necessarily see it in other places. And we have to try to see it that way, because, again, we can just write it off for, this is his philosophy, and this is his party, and this is his that. We can write it off very easily. Another interesting thing that Reb Schwab says is that, getting a little bit ahead of ourselves into Purim, is that Hashem's name is never mentioned in the Megillah. Now, the word Hamelech, the king, appears many times in the Megillah, and according to Pshat, according to the basic interpretation, the king is referring to Achashverosh. But there's a famous comment, and I'm not sure if it's based on a medrash or what, but there's a famous comment that actually, every time it says Hamelech, the king, it's referring to Hashem. So you look at it as Pshat, simple interpretation, it's Achashverosh. Derech Remez, right? In Bederech Remez, in a hint form, an illusion, in a form of illusion, it's Hashem. And you think of it as what?
Yeah, But when it says he called his wife, I mean,
good. So that would mean that you have to. That would mean that you'd have to find some kind. You would think that that means therefore that you have to find some kind of mystical interpretation to it, right? Whenever you hear this kind of explanation, pshad is talking about Achashverosh. Remez in an allusion is referring to Hashem. Well, that means you got to take the whole. You got to take the whole Megillah and reinterpret it on a certain deeper, on a certain in a different dimension. So the way that that the question is brought down from Rav Schwab, it's like Rav Schwab is bothered by, really Hashem should share the same title as Achashverosh, the same title, the same word. That same word is going to mean Achashverosh or Hashem. Like really, Achashverosh was a Russia. The Gemara says he was an evil. He was corrupt. He was evil to the core. So and the same word is going to mean either him or Hashem. So Rav Schwab, yeah, according to what we're saying, it's very good. Because everything that he's doing, everything in the Megillah that Achashverosh did impacted the story of Purim. Impacted what happened to the Jewish people and what would happen to the Jewish people. So, B'derech Chemetz, it's Hashem. Yeah, it is Hashem. Because everything that he was doing was a manifestation of Hashem's decree.
Well, but Haman was also a big boy.
And Haman was also.
So, well,
But Haman was also. But Hamelech, but it says Melech, first of all, Haman was also, but the decrees were Achashverosh's, right? The one who carried out the decrees, that could only happen if Achashverosh decreed it to happen. So the point is, yeah, but Derech Remez, it's also referring to Hashem. Indirectly it's referring to Hashem, but it's not indirectly referring necessarily to a whole different interpretation of the Megillah, but it's referring to the fact that Achashverosh is that manifestation of Hashem. Believe it or not, and all his evil, he's still a manifestation of Hashem. He's Hashem's tool for bringing out his decree. So that's the thought here. So either, again, if we would just take the idea of the heart of kings in the hand of Hashem, we could have possibly learned it, you know, as you were saying, Boris, on a certain level of, you know, just realize this is Hashem. Just realize Hashem's decrees. Rav Schwab seems to be trying to take it a step further. Some kind of a step further. I hope I'm making sense of what I'm saying, because I'm not 100% clear about it. But that's how I would understand it. There's something that we have to make sure that we see and believe and accept that there's a lot more going on in these decisions than we realize. And as much as everybody say, well, that's how this president runs, and that's how president runs, and that's how the office of the presidency runs, and that's how politics runs. You know, many people have told me, and I believe this very strong, that every time we hear something in the news happening, we don't have half the story. We don't have a real understanding of what's going on. Everything has been taken on the way it happens, and based on that, people make their observations. But if you'd be in the kishka, so to speak, if you'd be working if you'd be involved in all the things that are happening, you'd know there's a lot more going on than what meets the eye. A lot more that's going to meet the eye. But you just say, but that's the way it is. That's the natural way of things happening there. I think the idea that Rav Schwab is trying to learn in the pasuk, that the heart of kings in the hand of Hashem, is that, no, there's actually, don't just look at that as, well, that's the way things work here. There's a lot more going on that's not fitting within nature than is. And that's because it's in these areas that the hand of Hashem is intervening in a way more than within our natural order of things, perhaps. All right. Let's now move on to Perek Zion Pasuk Yud Tes. Okay. Page 326. This is at the beginning of the plague of blood. So Pasuk Tes, the middle of the page. Vayemer Hashem el Moshe, Hashem said to Moshe, Emor al Aaron, say to Aaron, Kach matcha, take your staff, Unateyotcha meim Mitzrayim, and spread out your hand on the waters of Egypt, and everything is going to turn into blood. So Rashi makes a comment on the fact that Hashem told Moshe to tell Aaron to perform this plague. We know the first three plagues were performed by Aaron, the rest performed by Moshe. Why? And so Rashi says, "Lefi shehegen ayar al meishek shnishak l'seichai," being that the river protected Moshe when he was put into the river. "Lefikach leilaka al yaday," therefore it could not be smitten through him. "Loi bedam loi betzvardim," not when it came to the plague of blood, which was a smiting of the Nile. Not when it came to the frogs, that was again smiting the Nile. It had to be done through Aaron. Moshe benefited from the Nile, and therefore he cannot perform the plague that happened there.
What is the third?
The third is kinim, lice, which came from the ground.
Yeah.
And being that Moshe was able to bury the Egyptian that he killed in the ground, he could not bring a plague on the ground. Rashi says that later by kinim.
Okay.
Okay. Now, so the way we should be understanding this is that from the fact that the last seven were done by Moshe, is that in essence these plagues should be done by Moshe. But because of the fact that Moshe benefited from the Nile and from the dirt, therefore he could not be the one to bring a plague upon them. Now, this is seemingly, it's the concept of gratitude, right? You benefit from something, you treat it right. It's very interesting, that's the idea of gratitude to an inanimate object, right? The water, the dirt doesn't know the difference. They didn't do you a favor, and they're not going to feel the favor back. And the way to understand this is that, gratitude is not a payback in the sense that, well, if somebody does you a favor, it's like he lends you money. You got to pay him back. And if that's what it is, if it's just a payback, well, then you don't pay back something that's inanimate. But the way to understand it is that the feelings of gratitude, it's not about payback. It's really about feeling gratitude. It's really about appreciating what you have received. And when you appreciate what you have received, no matter what you receive it from, you're going to feel gratitude towards it. And when you feel gratitude towards it, there's a certain way of how you should be treating it. Gratitude is something that we have to have within ourselves. It has to be part of us. It has to be a trait. It has to be part of who we are, that we feel gratitude, that when we receive goodness from something, we feel gratitude. Because ultimately, we're supposed to take those feelings of gratitude and apply them to our service of Hashem. And because we feel gratitude for all the good that He does for us, we reciprocate that gratitude by serving Him. So in essence, gratitude is supposed to be a feeling that we feel within ourselves. We are supposed to show gratitude to one another so that we come to show gratitude to Hashem. If we don't show gratitude to one another, if we don't develop gratitude within ourselves, then we're not going to show gratitude to Hashem. But gratitude has to be something that has to be like a natural reaction. It has to be part of who we are. It has to be a natural emotional reaction. And it should be acted upon, because that is what gratitude is supposed to bring you to. So it's not about paying back the rock, but it's about making sure that gratitude is operating within you. Because if gratitude is going to be operating within you, then you should feel gratitude towards everything that you benefited from. And you should act towards it properly. If you don't act towards it in that way, you're actually going against, you're actually blemishing your feelings of gratitude. You're actually doing something against, let me change it. You don't react with that gratitude in some way. You're not strengthening it. You're not making sure that it remains part of you, that it is part of you. Even if it's inanimate, it's not about paying back the rock. It's not about paying back anybody. It's about developing a sense, well, it is about bringing yourself to pay back Hashem. But we need to develop a sense of gratitude within ourselves. It has to be part of our natural reactions. And if it's going to be part of our natural reactions, it has to be a reaction towards everything. Because if it's going to be not react to everything, then we're going to weaken it within ourselves. So therefore, it's not appropriate for Moshe to bring a plague upon the things they benefited from, because there should be a sense of gratitude to that. And in a sense of gratitude to something, you don't bring something bad upon it. You don't bring ruin upon it. You don't bring a plague upon it. You don't bring something negative upon it. But that's because it's not about the recipient. it's not just about the recipient. It's not just about making sure you pay back a debt, like if you borrow money from someone. It's about developing a sense and a trait and a sense of gratitude within yourself, and to make sure that that sense of gratitude is there and operating properly. That sense of gratitude should be applied to everything. Now, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz uses the gratitude here to explain something very interesting. If we go to Parshas Matos, and we go to page 902. Page 902, Parak Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. The bottom Pasuk on the page. Pasuk reads, Vaydabra Hashem al Moshe, Leimer, Hashem spoke to Moshe, saying, Nekom Nikmas Bnei Yisrael, take vengeance for the Jewish people, Me'ez HaMidyanim, from the Midianites, Achar Teyasav Alabecha, and after that you shall be gathered unto your people. Okay? Moshe, Hashem tells him, take the revenge from the Midianites for what they did to you. And Moshe gathers an army of the Jewish people together. And who does he send out to fight the war? Pinchas. He doesn't go. He does not go. And the Medrash is bothered by the fact that Hashem told Moshe, Nekom Nikmas Midyanim, you're supposed to take revenge from the Midyanim. You take revenge means you take revenge. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Amar Moshe, Nekom Ba'atzmacha. Hashem tells Moshe, take vengeance. That means you do it. V'hu Shaleach Achayim, and he sends others. Elal Yudeshin, Eskadol B'Midyan, being that Moshe survived in Midian, and he grew in Midian, he developed in Midian, he was in Midian for many years. Omar, he said, Eina bedin sh'ani meitzel misha asali taiva. It's not right that I bring suffering upon those who did me a favor. Right? They saved him. They gave him a place to live. He was running away from Paro. He came to Midian. He was safe there. He got married there. He developed who he was there. And therefore, he said, it's not right that I bring suffering upon those who did me a favor. So Reb Chaim Shmulevitz asks, but still, I mean, Hashem gave him a mitzvah. Hashem told him, take vengeance. He gave you a mitzvah. So who are you to start saying, it's not right. I have to show them gratitude. What do you mean? Hashem told you to do something. Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, it must be, the Moshe Rabbeinu understood that because of this idea of hakaras hatov, of gratitude, Moshe Rabbeinu knew that this is what he is this is how he's obligated to act. He's obligated to behave based on gratitude, and therefore, Hashem must mean
send
someone else. How did Moshe Rabbeinu know that he has to be acting with gratitude? How did he know that? Says Reb Chaim Shmulevitz from this week's parasha. Because when Hashem was bringing the plagues upon the Egyptians, when it should have been done through Moshe, Hashem said, no, Moshe, you don't do three of them. Aaron does three of them. Why? Because you benefited from the river. You benefited from the ground. Therefore, it's Aaron who's going to do those three. You'll do the rest. So from there, Moshe understood that Hashem wants him to act with gratitude. When it came to the plagues, where Moshe should have been the one carrying out the plagues, but no, he's not going to be the one carrying out the plagues because he has to show gratitude to the water and to the dirt. That's where Moshe Rabbeinu sees that he has to live based on gratitude. And therefore, when it comes to taking the revenge from Midian, if he is supposed to be acting with gratitude, it can't mean that he's supposed to be the one to do it. And he was right. All this because of this idea of gratitude. Now, I want to share with you a question that I think is a very interesting question. It's a famous question. And I don't know if the answer is exactly going to fit in with what we've been saying right now. But Rabbi Mordechai Kamenetsky asks the following question, and it's a famous question. Moshe Rabbeinu shouldn't bring the plague of blood upon the water because he owes gratitude to the water. But the plague, if the water is going to be used for the plague, right, then the water is being used for a Kiddush Hashem. It's being used to sanctify God's name. The Makkos, the plagues in Mitzrayim, were there to bring about the honor of Hashem. These were the way that Hashem revealed himself to the Jewish people, to the Egyptians. You know, basically, if you let that water be turned into blood, you're actually elevating the water. You're giving the water a chance to be Hashem's tool in bringing about his honor. Yeah. And bringing the Jews out of Mitzrayim. So you're not hurting the dirt.
Or if you leave the frogs out of the water.
What?
If you leave the frogs out of the water, you don't hurt the water.
Well, that's considered a plague on the water. It was a makkah. You're asking a different question now. You're saying, you know, blood in the water. There are always frogs in the water. What's the big deal if the frogs come out of the water? But for so many frogs that come out of the water, and to actually be a source of punishment, of a source of suffering, is considered a plague to the water. Right? It's considered a plague to the water. But even if it is, you're supposed to have gratitude to the water. This gives the water a chance to bring about the greatest honor to Hashem. You're not mistreating it. You're actually elevating it, because now it's creating the miracles and sanctifying Hashem's name. So Moshe Rabbeinu should want to use the water for that. And should want to use the dirt for that. What do you say to that question? It's an interesting question. So Mordechai Kamenetsky's answer is a very interesting one. And he basically starts off with a story. The story is not an exact comparison, but it's the idea. So this is a famous story. A certain Rav was brought the following dintar, the following dispute. There was a merchant who came to Krakow, and when he was going through the marketplace, he noticed this woman, elderly woman, who she was selling rolls. When she wasn't selling the rolls, she was saying tilim, and she seemed very devout and very righteous. And when she only stopped saying tilim when somebody came to buy from her, and anytime she sold something to the customer, she thanked the customer, she gave the customer a bracha. And he watched her, and he was very impressed with her. And after a couple of times of coming to the marketplace and noticing her, he decided, this woman shouldn't have to bother, you know, sitting out here and selling her stuff. She should be given a chance to be able to say tilim a whole day and do what she wants to do a whole day in the service of Hashem, and perhaps do other mitzvahs and everything. She's a righteous woman. She should be given the chance to serve Hashem the way she wants to, not to have to interrupt her service of Hashem to sell rolls to support herself. So basically he approached her and he said, Ebbetson, you don't have to do this anymore. I'm going to give you money, and you don't have to do this. You could just spend a whole day doing mitzvahs. And she was so excited. She was so happy. She thanked him and she blessed him. Okay? He gave her some money, you know, and he figured the next time he would come back to Krakow, we'll visit her and give her more money. Comes back to Krakow. What is she doing? She's sitting outside again selling the rolls. What's going on? So she says, you know, I don't like this freebie stuff. This is not good for me. You know, when I used to sell my rolls, every time it rained, I thanked Hashem for the rain. Because if it rained, that means that the wheat would grow. And when the weather was good, I thought about the farmers cutting the wheat, and I thanked Hashem for the fact that farmers could cut the wheat. And then when I would buy the wheat, I would thank Hashem for the fact that there was enough wheat and that the wheat came here on time, that I should be able to grind it. And when I would grind it and grind it well, and it would come out and I would bake it and it would bake beautifully, I thanked Hashem for all his kindness. And then when I would sell it, I would thank Hashem for giving me my parnasa. And now I just don't have it anymore. So she saved the money, she gave it back to him. And he said, a deal is a deal. You're not getting out of this so fast. So they went to the Rav for him to settle the dispute. And I think at the end, he doesn't bring it down this way, but when I've seen the story at different points, the Rav Paskud, like the one who didn't want it, he gave permission for to back out of the deal. In the sense that if this is to your detriment, That's never, the deal was never made for that. Okay. So here you have a woman who's taking everything that happens to her and seeing it as a gift from Hashem and using that to thank Hashem, and she didn't want to lose out on that. So Rabbi Kamenetsky wants to suggest that by Moshe Rabbeinu, every time he passed the Nile River, you know what he said? He said, thank you, Hashem, for saving me. Every time he saw that Nile River, every time he saw that river, he thanked Hashem, because this is what saved him. And I guess every time he looked at the dirt, he said to himself, you know, this dirt saved me. The water and the dirt were his utensils, were his means of thanking Hashem. And therefore, even if by now basically having the water turn into blood, so it's not water anymore, or the dirt turning into lice, it's not dirt anymore, right? You could say, well, now it's being elevated to make a Kiddush Hashem. But at the end of the day, Moshe Rabbeinu was now losing out on his means of giving thanks to Hashem. And therefore, he couldn't be the one to do that. It's going to have to happen, because Hashem has a decree. It's going to have to happen. It's going to have to happen. But for you, who use this as a means to thank Hashem, because that's what Moshe Rabbeinu used the water and the dirt for, he couldn't be the one to stop that. Because this is his means to thank Hashem. So it's not your simple like gratitude idea as much as kind of a different idea. Which means when Rashi says that he couldn't hit the water and he couldn't hit the...
He didn't say hit, it says raise you.
Yeah, bring the makkah. Okay, but he couldn't bring the makkah on the water, he couldn't bring the plague on the dirt, because they protected him. According to this, it's not exactly about gratitude as much as, you know, this was his means of thanking Hashem, and therefore this can't be something that he stops it from being that way. A little bit different. I was thinking, and I didn't think this out 100%, but I was thinking that maybe the reason, what it means, you know, to answer his question, but, you know, it's not ingratitude to bring a plague upon them. You're elevating them. They're being used to sanctify Hashem's name. Maybe, again, didn't have a chance to think this out well, but maybe what it means is that, yeah, you're definitely elevating it and giving it, making it a tool to sanctify Hashem's name. But it's almost like, but people, it still appears as a plague, right? It still appears as a plague. It still appears as something negative to the water, something negative to the ground. So either you'll say that, you know, so deep, deep down, it would be impossible that it wouldn't in some way negatively affect Moshe's feelings of gratitude. Or perhaps, again, it would be how people would look at it, in the sense of, right, this is, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu is supposed to be, should have gratitude here. And instead he's bringing a plague. Well, it's to sanctify Hashem's name. But when people see it as a plague, which it was, maybe in some way or another, that kind of, at least in people's eyes, appears at a certain level of ingratitude. Maybe that's the answer, but I just thought it was an interesting question. I wanted to share it with you. And it's also an interesting answer. Okay.
So, by the way, about lice, I didn't have a chance to... The text...
Kinim.
Actually, no, but does it actually say that they came from...
Yeah.
What dirt. About locusts? It didn't?
No.
Only about lice.
Yeah. Okay. Let's now... take a look. I've got to turn back to page. Back to page 326. Actually, let's turn to page 328. Page 328, Perek Ches Pasek Beis. This is by the plague of the frogs. Vayit Aaron es yadai, Aaron stretched out his hand, Almeim Mitzrayim over the waters of Egypt. Vatal hatzvardeya, and the frogs came up, vatachas eretz Mitzrayim, and covered the land of Egypt. Now Rashi's comment has a comment here, a famous comment. Tzvardeya is single, literally which means one frog, and throughout this, the plague of frogs, the frogs are called tzvardeim, which is a plural form. So why here does it say singular form? Therefore, Rashi cites a famous medrash that actually what happened here with Talatz Tavardea. Tavardea achas haisa. It started off as one frog. So the Egyptians attacked it. V'imatezes nechilim nechilim. And as they whacked it, streams of frogs came out of it. Famous medrash. Okay? So first it was this, you know, giant frog that came out, right? And Rashi's not ready to say that the giant frog covered the entire land of Egypt because it would have crushed everything, probably. So what it means, but what's the singular form? Different than all other times. The answer is, because first came out this giant frog, right? You know, and everyone attacked it and hit it, and as they hit it, it streamed out millions of little frogs, and that is what covered Egypt. Now, it doesn't say what happened to the giant frog. Did it die? Did it eventually turn, like, just disappear because it turned into a lot of little frogs? It doesn't say, right? And the wording here, at least in Rashi, is Hayumakinoisa, they were hitting it, and it would then, you know, stream these little frogs. And that's how it covered Egypt. So how many times do you think they hit it?
Well, we don't know how many came out after each hit.
We don't know. So, but it also says Makin, they were hitting, which sounds like it was more than one.
Right, but if each time a million frogs comes out, even if they hit it 10 times, then it's 10 million, it should be enough to cover.
I couldn't tell you. I mean, don't know. But clearly, they probably hit it a number of times, right? So the question is asked, this is a famous question. So the big frog came out, right? They started hitting it. Didn't seem to be working right. Unless they felt it was better to have a million little ones than this giant frog. I don't know. But they're hitting it and it's streaming out frogs. Seemingly this hitting isn't working, right? So what do you think they should do? Should they like stop right away? Like how long should they keep hitting it before they realize that they're actually the place is going to be covered with frogs now because you're hitting it so much? Now, maybe you want to say, well, I don't know how many times they hit it. They hit it so many times, but it was enough times to spread it all over the place. It's an argument can be made that they hit it a lot of times, and that's why so many frogs came out. That's what it kind of sounds like. But then you'd ask, but why would you do that? Like, stop if it's not working. So the answer that's given is it's an example of what happens when you lose your temper, when you kind of lose control. Something upsets you, you become hyper-focused on it, and you stop thinking, right? You want to get this frog, right? But it's sprouting more frogs. Stop, I'm going to get this frog. It's the reaction we have when we get angry and upset about something. We become totally focused on what's upsetting us, and everything else is forgotten to our detriment. So I just want to use this as an example to bring out a beautiful story about someone who didn't get angry.
Did not
get angry. Okay, an example, an unbelievable example, someone didn't get angry. Perhaps I've said this before. But I heard this from the person who experienced it. This is not hearing it from another speaker. I heard it from the person who experienced it. And I call the story The Roofer and the Homeowner, because I got to call it something so we can identify the characters. Okay? So a roofer receives a phone call that the house that his crew had worked on is on fire. It's burning. And he dials the number of the homeowner, because he had his phone number, he was in contact with him, and the response on the phone is an emotional response of, you burned my house down. Meaning your workers burned my house down. Okay. There was a big commotion in the background, fire trucks, wherever it was. The roofer figured there's really no point for me to come down now. He told them, I will be there tomorrow morning, first thing in the morning. The next morning, the roofer goes to see the house. No more house. House is gone. He comes face to face with the owner. They extend cordial greetings. The roofer says, good morning. What is he going to say? And the homeowner says, nice to meet you. And the roofer says, do you mind if I walk through the house? And the homeowner replies, by all means. And they walk through the devastated house. The homeowner keeps repeating calmly, it is what it is. It is what it is. The homeowner then turns to the roofer and gave him a compliment, a real compliment. He wasn't being sarcastic. And he says, you know, you came so highly recommended, I was really fine with you doing the job. And the roofer saying to himself, he's complimenting me? Burnt his house and he's complimenting me? And the homeowner continues and he says, listen, it's from heaven. Hashem decided that this should happen, and for some reason, you should be his emissary. You should be his shliach. This doesn't break me. I accept it. We'll work it out together. Work it out together. And again, the roofer thinking to himself, I can't believe this. No screaming, no yelling. We'll work it out together, he says. When they reached the master bedroom, the roofer saw that everything was gone. All his clothing were gone. He takes out his credit card and says to the homeowner, take this and buy yourself a suit, shirt, and shoes for Shabbos. The homeowner says, absolutely not. This is from Hashem. You don't loan me a suit. Or I'll put in parentheses, at least not yet. You don't owe me a suit. So finally, the roofer says to him, it's unbelievable. Like, how do you act like this? Your demeanor is unbelievable. So the homeowner said to him like this, 20 years ago, I had a very good friend. Everything bothered him. The weather, his wife's shoes, the rabbi's sermon, everything bothered him. And he died of a heart attack because everything bothered him. When that happened, I made a conscious decision then that I am not going to let anything bother me. But you see from his reaction, if you want nothing to bother you, you have to have bitachon in Hashem. Right? That's going to be your best way. Is it possible in any other way? Probably very hard. The best, and this way is not so easy either. The way that you're going to be able to control your anger, because anger is about things are out of order, things are not the way I want them to be. The way that you overcome that is understanding that everything is Biyad Hashem. Everything's in Hashem's hand. And the roofer commented, to end the story, the roofer commented later, they could have made himself very unavailable in regard to the investigation. An investigation has to go on, right? He made himself very unavailable. But he cooperated fully because of how this man acted. You act like a mensch, he'll be treated like a mensch. And again, you know, you think about it, you know, not the roofer can make himself unavailable. Why should make himself unavailable? You know, where's your responsibility? But it's natural, especially if the guy is coming at you like an animal. It's just a reaction. But you don't think twice about it if the guy's a mensch, if the guy's acting like a real mensch, not just a real mensch, like a tzaddik. So I want you to use this as to bring out, you know, in the case of Sfaradeya, we see the results of anger. And in this story, we see how a person can come to the point where he doesn't get angry. And he doesn't get angry when it would make all the sense in the world that he should be angry. But he accepts it as Hashem's decree, and he knows it's what Hashem wants. Whoever did it was Hashem's shliach, and because of that, he's able to live a life of serenity. Good night. All right. I hope that first thought that I had on you was a tough one. I still not.